On the Empire Podcast this week, Evangeline Lilly drops by in a lovely big red top hat to talk about The Hobbit and her children's book, The Skwikawonkers, and 27%er Benedict Wong comes in to talk Marco Polo. All that and more on the only movie podcast that recommends avoiding Finsbury Park Station before 9 a.m. on weekdays. Absolute carnage. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. Just three of us this week to chow yon fat. But what a threesome it is. First up is our film fact fiend, a man who's forgotten more about movie trivia than he'll ever know. It's Ali Plum. How are
Hello.
You?
Hello. Did you know that Christoph Waltz did the German and French dubs for Inglourious Basterds?
I did not know that.
Well, he did.
Good facting. Last but not least, of all three of us, is our art house guru who's celebrating his birthday today. I haven't even wished you happy birthday. So remiss of me, so sorry. At the time of recording, by the time you guys listen to this, his birthday will have passed. It is, of course, Phil Desemlian, and even his birthday cake is subtitled. That's how much he loves art house movies. Hello, Phil. Happy birthday.
Hi. Thanks very much. I'm conscious that there's been talk of this becoming the plague cast over the last couple of weeks because of my husky.
A single tweet,
cold.
I think.
The world is abuzz with this chat. Yeah. Will they live another day, or it will become World War Z in there? Yes, I'm good. What was the question?
I don't know.
Oh, hi, Chris.
The question wasn't a question. The question was me wishing you a happy birthday. Should we have a quick...
No, let's not. But when you say GoldenEye, do you have that urge to sing GoldenEye? Do you ever have that?
Dun, 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 dun. No.
Oh.
I do have the urge to get on the old N64 and have a quick scrummage around.
Oh, that's good, that.
Were you playing rugby?
Scrummage.
Yeah. Did you not get that?
No, it's a game we have to shoot people in the head.
It's a hidden level. It's a secret level.
It's a secret level.
Yeah. It's great. I love that game. Amazing. Oh, that's so good. Finish your job, James. For England.
Did you see that?
Buy me a pint.
Did you see that video? I think it was Jimmy Fallon where... Pierce Brosnan plays N64 GoldenEye with Jimmy Fallon, and
yes.
Jimmy Fallon's just wetting himself.
Yes.
He's just going, he says out loud halfway through, "I can't believe this is happening."
Yes. What I love about that was that Pierce Brosnan had clearly agreed to do it and had never played the game before in his life or knew what was happening.
He didn't know that you should always play an odd job as much as you can because he's shorter.
And he is shorter.
So,
oh.
Yeah. So the line of sight isn't the same.
What's Sean Bean's character called?
Alec Trevelyan, 006.
And you're almost guaranteed to die early on. If you play him.
No.
Is he good?
Because he comes back. You must remember GoldenEye.
Oh, yeah. But
it's a film that makes me, it just gives me the urge to appear upside down in someone's toilet cubicle and go, "So sorry, forgot to knock." Which is
or get in a tank and drive through a building.
While adjusting your tie in cool fashion. Or have an absolutely dreadful score. But I think we may have banged this drum before, just like Eric Serra does in his silly little drums. Anyway, speaking of Bond, in a way of interesting segue, your questions you've been sending to us all week via Twitter. Here's one from @NJMag. He says, "G'day, Pod. I'm presuming you're Australian, sir. With a new Bond announcement, who do you think should sing the theme? I'd like..." This is NJMag. "I'd like to see Elbow have a shot."
I think it's notable that Daniel Craig hasn't sung it himself. Is there a reason?
What, in the scene? Just...
No, not in the scene. That would be ridiculous.
Well, he's walking along going, "James Bond, James Bond, James Bond." No.
We've had a lot of discussion in the office about what, whoever it could be, Adele, Sam Smith, whoever it might end up being, Elbow here, might rhyme with Spectre. And so far I've got overhead projector.
Yes.
Tax inspector. Phil suggested boa constrictor. Would you like a game of Connect Four?
Ooh. Erector.
Erector.
Erector, yeah.
Tipex typo corrector.
Yeah.
Rampant conjecture. And...
Protractor. You could have a mathematical theme.
Arcade Fire had a track called Reflector.
Yes.
So why don't you use that? Why don't you make it Arcade Fire and just change the lyrics?
Just an inspector.
He's from Spectre.
This is a brilliant idea. Okay, well, we've answered the question with Arcade Fire.
I'm not accepting that. My favourite Bond theme of recent years is the Chris Cornell one. Oh. I like the Bond themes when they go a bit rocky.
Pearl Jam, then. Has there ever been a song that says James Bond in a James Bond song?
No.
So why does whenever anybody sings the Bond theme, it's always...
That'd be interesting. Pearl Jam.
What the hell was that?
Their name's Jam. Pearl Jam.
That's very good.
Just imagine it.
Wait, Mississippi Mud Blues Man. I've got it.
You've got it.
I've got it. Yep.
He's got it.
True answer. Brett McKenzie.
Wow.
Brett McKenzie doing Flight of the Conchords style pastiche Bond theme for Spectre, I think would be amazing. Because he could do like a sort of period homage to the early themes. Yeah. And it would be genius.
That'd be pretty good. That'd be pretty good. I think the Bond theme should be given to whoever wins X Factor that year.
Yeah, good idea.
To be honest, I think that's a good shout. And in fact, I'm going to say something now which will earn me widespread derision, even more so than usual. I would genuinely go for Rebecca Ferguson. I may have said this before in the podcast. It seems like I've said it before, or maybe it's what I say when I get home at the end of the day and I rant to myself in the mirror. Rebecca Ferguson came second in X Factor of the Year. One Direction came third. She has the voice of an angel. An angel, I tell you. And she should do it.
Satan was an angel originally. Just as facts there for you.
Who's he with? Universal.
Satan, yeah. Simon Cowell's protege.
Well, there's an idea. You've mentioned One Direction. Surely that'll get people's bums on seats.
They could change the name to Bond Direction for the thing, wouldn't they? That'd be cool.
I mean, they could. Surely it'd be One Direction should be 007 Direction.
Oh, that's good.
It's all right. I'm actually Elbow going full circle. Elbow wouldn't be a bad pick for this.
And I think a lot of people have been talking about Sam Smith as being the shoe-in. But frankly, if it was Adele again, I'd be happy.
Just do the same theme as last time. I really liked it. That was a winner.
Spectre.
Just not Madonna, basically.
No, not Madonna. All right, let's move on. Next question is from at Ross T. Miller. Robert G. Durant, who says, what's the best first performance by a famous actor? Duval in Mockingbird? McConaughey in Dazed and Confused? It's two shining examples for us to get to grips with and then spin off.
I'm going to count to three. There won't be a four.
I'm going to count to three.
Oh, don't beat my
Oh,
my goober accent is not good at all. But I mean, Alan Rickman had been in things on TV before Die Hard, but Die Hard was his big screen debut, so that counts.
That's an amazing.
That performance. Counts. Genius.
Dave Prowse in Star Wars. Peter Mayhew in Star Wars. Done.
I just noticed you're wearing a Cuban Fury sweat top.
I am wearing a Cuban Fury sweat top.
I didn't know. Why did they need such a thing?
To promote the motion picture Cuban Fury starring Nick Frost and Chris O'Dowd. Okay. Obviously. Which is now out on DVD and Blu-ray. Why do you ask?
I just think I heard the sound of a till receipt going.
There's no corruption on this podcast. It's interesting because you think, you know, if you're going to be sousering hard, you're not going to need a sweat top, are you?
If it's first film, would Shaun of the Dead, anybody there, be their first film, or were the actors in there all...
Ooh, Dylan Moran, potentially?
It would be Nick Frost's first film, definitely.
That's what I was thinking, and that's a bloody good job from Nick.
That's a bloody good job indeed. Bloody good job. Taron Egerton, who's the star of Kingsman: The Secret Service, which is out in January, had never been on a movie set until he set foot on Kingsman for his very first day. And then he was strapped to a contraption, I believe it's called Colin Firth, and then just, you know, catapulted 60 feet into the sky.
Colin Firth is also a catapult.
He's very versatile.
He's a very good actor. That's what you get when you
win
an Oscar.
That in the locker. Not to, this can't live without, but Orson Welles.
I know.
The first day on Citizen Kane, also catapulted across Xanadu. He also wrote and directed that one, so that was impressive. Aged, 27?
A bit of a show-off, that
was one. Was he 28? I don't know. He was young.
He was 25, wasn't he?
Was he 25?
Yeah,
Christ,
I think he was.
Christ, that's ridiculous.
It is, it's crazy.
That is genuinely ridiculous.
Like, it's like, stop doing it.
Hey, 25 years old, that's ridiculous. Recently, Jennifer Lawrence in Winter's Bone.
Not bad.
Oh, hello. Dan Stevens wasn't on debut in The Guest, obviously, because he'd been in Summer in February and one or two others, I believe. But, you know, people sometimes just appear on the screen ready to go as a movie star, and Jennifer Lawrence definitely did that, I think. Lupita Nyong'o in 12 Years a Slave this year. But there's been lots down the years, hasn't there? Barbara Streisand in Funny Girl.
Was that her first film?
First film.
Wow.
Yeah. Tatum O'Neill, one of the great child performances in Bogdanovich's Paper Moon. Mm-hmm. A film that everybody should see as soon as possible. Ed Norton in Primal Fear.
Yeah.
On a way, too.
The ones I usually think of are the ones who are famous for making inauspicious debuts. So you do get your Stallones in, I think, was he an Italian Stallion, that dreadful sort of semi-porn film he made, or, you know, his appearance, very brief appearance in Bananas, where he, you know, threatens Woody Allen on the subway train, or Sigourney Weaver showing up in 10 seconds of Annie Hall. You think of those, but of the great great first-time performances. I think we've covered quite a few of them, to be honest. I mean, the two that are mentioned here, Duvall in To Kill a Mockingbird and McConaughey in Dazed and Confused, are cracking.
If you were to do this for directors, it would probably be a much longer conversation, I guess. That's because often directors have been, you know, working on their craft a long time before they got their film to the screen, whereas actors learn as they go. I don't know. That'd be my guess.
That would be the guess. I think that's a good list. Let's move on to one very, very last question. This is from at Mr. Oliver Warman, who says, do you have the balls to discuss this on the Empire podcast? And then he leaks to a Gawker story about this Sony leak, which is, if you haven't been following it in any way, shape or form, is Sony Pictures have been targeted by a cyber attack of the last few weeks, which basically shut down their entire email system. People, hackers, hacked into the Sony system and have got lots of confidential emails and documents and whatnot, and have been slowly disseminating it in a WikiLeaks fashion. Some people suggested this may be linked in some way to the upcoming release of The Interview, that may be retaliation from a group who may or may not be aggrieved by that film's portrayal of North Korea and its leader, Kim Jong-un. It's hard to say. North Korea have denied responsibility for the attack. A group called Guardians of Peace have come forward and claimed responsibility for the attack. And the attack itself has garnered a lot of publicity over the last few days. I mean, there's been a lot of private and confidential emails that have made their way onto the internet, featuring discussions between Amy Pascal, the head of Sony, and Scott Rudin, who's a major, major producer. He's a guy who's doing Jobs, and he did Captain Phillips, and works for the Coen brothers constantly. He's big, heavy-duty Hollywood producer. And lots of other things as well, where they talk about, there's talks about James Bond, and what the next Jump Street movie might be, and Spider-Man, and all this sort of stuff. It's out there on the internet if you want to get into it. Tricky one for us. We don't want to get into it, because
we're ethical journalists.
Yes. We are journalists. I have a course. I did a course. I have a document. I am a journalist. I took an ethics course and everything. For us, this is very akin to the iCloud leak, the hack into the iCloud that happened a few months ago, where people's naked photographs were leaked onto the internet. We didn't talk about it then. We didn't share any information about it then. And we didn't look at them then. Trust us, we didn't look at them. And similarly, it's the same thing with this. It's hard to avoid it. I know the broad strokes of what people are talking about, because it's there on Twitter every 5 minutes, and you have people like Megan Ellison, who's the producer of the new Terminator movie, and she's a mini mogul in her own right, and she responded on Twitter to something that Scott Rudin said about her in an email. She responded with grace and class, and it was very, very funny, her response. But we're not going to get into it, because we didn't discuss the naked photographs, and we're not going to discuss this. Just from an ethical point of view, it's something that Empire is staying away from.
It absolutely screws my Jobs updates.
It does screw your Jobs updates.
Totally screws it.
It kind of does, and it kind of doesn't, because now Jobs has moved to a different studio, is now at Universal.
True, that's true. Well, the thing about a lot of this information is that it is now of historical interest, I suppose, rather than current news interest, because these are emails that leaked that have come across from the last couple of years. So,
yes.
You know, there's stuff about the new Bond film, which is now out of date, I suppose. But, you know, and if you go there, and you can go there because it's online, it will spoil some pretty major points of interest. So, yeah, I mean, just
for me personally, from an ethical point of view, a crime has taken place.
Mm.
These emails, these documents should not be online. And I'm kind of uncomfortable with the way people are clawing over themselves, and certain websites are clawing over themselves to publish it as quickly as they possibly can. Yes, it's kind of cool to get a little peek inside the Hollywood curtain and see that, you know, how the major players in the business interact with each other and what they say about each other.
Yeah,
that's kind of interesting, but at the same time, it feels a little bit shameful.
I think it would be to take it into a news environment like this podcast. Yeah. I must confess, for full transparency, that I retweeted the Gawker correspondence between Amy Pascal and Scott Rudin, because it was, you know, of interest from a Jobs point of view. But I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of this stuff coming out from now on, and there is a point where you're like, actually, it's not good. It's not good, I think, for moviegoers either, that this stuff is spilling out of one of the major studios in Hollywood.
Also, every good idea at its core comes from a spitballing, crazy one, right? Mm. Like, so many things that we decide to do, or I decide to do, I say to Phil, how about this bad pun? How about this good pun? You know, we come up with absolute nonsense. What if everything that you said, which was a bit stupid and a bit weird and a bit how about that, just everyone read? There are some stuff that I read and I go, well, that's definitely something that people were just talking about. And like you say, happened 2 years ago.
I think you're right, because it is a crime, and that does have to temper your treatment of it as a journalist, I would say. And it's not WikiLeaks either. I don't know if there's a public interest defence for finding out what the plot of
23 Jump Street 23,
well, yeah. Actually, maybe that one. But no, generally, there isn't a public interest, not WikiLeaks. This is not stuff that affects our daily lives. It's just of pure interest. And you're right, it's criminal, so you have to treat it with... So do we have the balls to talk about it? I think...
We just have.
I guess so. But
we,
I mean,
we talked around
that's
it.
Our, that's yeah. our philosophy towards it. But I'm sure in weeks to come, it's going to be tricky because there'll be things we'll want to talk about that will be augmented by other news that has come from within this leak, and we'll have to figure that out as we go. So,
yeah. Do we have the balls to talk about it? Yes, we do. Do we have the balls to actually engage with it? Yes, we do. But we're ethically staying away from it.
Are we responsible journalists? Not yet. But we will be.
We're trying to be.
One day.
We're trying to be. Don't let the Lou Blooms win. That's what I say. Okay, if you want to have your question read out on the Emperor podcast, then by all means do send in. We're on Twitter as @EmperorMagazine. Use the hashtag Emperor podcast, or chances are we won't see it. We're on Facebook as well, Emperor Magazine. And of course, you can email us, podcast@empireonline.com. is the email address. Okay, time now for our first interview. Benedict Wong is one of those actors that we like to call the 27 presenters. They're character actors that turn up and stuff and improve it generally by 27%. You've seen and enjoyed him in the likes of Prometheus, Sunshine, and yes, the Street Countdown episode of The IT Crowd. Now he's getting his biggest break to date as Kublai Khan in Netflix's epic show, Marco Polo. He came in to talk to Phil and myself about that, Last of the Summer Wine, and being typecast as a Chinese thug. Enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on the Emperor podcast by the star of Netflix's Marco Polo, Mr. Benedict Wong. Hello, sir. How are you?
Hello there.
Good to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, is Marco Polo the most dangerous set you've ever been on? Because we ran a set visit report in Empire a couple of months ago, and there was talk in that of white spitting cobras on the set and all sorts, and you know, are you lucky to be alive, essentially?
Yeah, you just gotta have very, very quick reflexes. That's it. There was a cobra there.
Feel free to exaggerate, by the way.
There was a huge cobra. Yeah, no, they're just one size, aren't they, really?
Just yeah, big, yeah. Just generally big. Even nowadays, in this golden age of TV, people think, oh, a TV show, and they think, oh, it's going to be quite low key, maybe quite low budget. But Marco Polo, I mean, you know, Netflix have thrown a fair amount of money at this. You shot it in the Pinewood Studios in Malaysia.
This is ambitious. I mean, we've got Netflix joining forces with the Weinstein Company, and, you know, it just feels like it's come at such an amazing time. And John Fusco, his piece of Marco Polo coming to fruition, and we've had about people from 27 different countries coming all over to this newly built Pinewood Studios in Malaysia, in Johor Bahru. We've been filming in Venice, Kazakhstan, we've just taken all over the studios,
Get a chance to see what you would look like with a rock and tash.
Yeah, but I sort of plied on the pounds a bit as well, because I think I put on about 30 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was quite easy. He's quite a big, burly guy.
The Kublai Khan diet. Yeah. What is the Kublai Khan diet?
Well, I think we're going to do like a side, a DVD's extra of like Khan versus food, which you'll be hopefully seeing. You know, it wasn't as romantic as De Niro's walking around the streets of Italy enjoying the delicious pasta. I think I wandered around the streets of London eating fried chicken, Kennington fried chicken, Kensington fried chicken, rather expensive, but...
Oh, really?
It's just Carb City, isn't it? You know. Yeah.
But at the same time, you have to, because as you said, you have, you know, there's elaborate fight sequences, elaborate battle sequences, you know. So I imagine at the same time, you have to keep yourself in some shape.
Yes. I mean, like, I'm kind of, keep myself agile. A little bit sort of limbered up. But he's certainly someone who's past his kind of physical prime, you know, shall we say. Like a worn warrior. I mean, I'm playing him, and he's 60 at the time now.
There is a very memorable moment where Marco Polo presents
the emperor with a ladle made from the ball sack of an elephant, which he then he then proceeds to use to beat a man to death with about 3 minutes later.
Yeah, I think he had the same one. Obviously, he wasn't pleased. Yeah.
Did you get to keep the ladle?
You know what? I think I went through a few of those, actually, yeah.
You've been in two TV shows that have gone on to be, possibly even more, that have gone on to become feature-length movies. One, Spooks, which was, you know, a one-off appearance. And State of Play, which is a fantastic BBC miniseries, which has aged brilliantly and, you know, probably was better than the film, if we're honest. Any other any of your other TV appearances you think would make good feature films? Anything you could see in a sort of feature-length context?
What can I see? I don't,
I think the IT would extend to a IT crowd would extend to a film.
IT crowd, the movie.
I would love to see Street Countdown, the movie. Never mind IT Street, crowd.
That's prime yeah, alone.
Absolutely, absolutely. Do you get challenged often to games of Street Countdown?
Yeah, people occasionally say Street Countdown towards me. Or
do you accept the challenge?
I do occasionally, yeah.
You have these rogue games in the street.
Yeah. Only in outside. Car parks. Yeah.
Okay, outside what? Kennington Fried Chicken. You're playing Street Countdown.
What is Street Countdown?
Street Countdown is in the episode The IT Crowd, where Benny plays a character called Prime, who is kind of, what do you say, the Lord Master of Street Countdown? It's as I said in the show, it's Countdown, but played in the street. Yeah. It's an amazing episode.
Oh, thank you.
It's
cheers. Great.
It's fantastic. And I wanted to take you back, actually, to the beginning of your career, because one of the very first things you did, we're talking about TV shows you did, one of the very first things you did, according to the IMDb, was you were in an episode of Last of the Summer Wine. Is this true?
This is true. And I was working with, it was Blakey from On the Buses. What's the actor called?
No way.
Do you remember him?
I do remember him.
Yeah,
remember.
We all remember
him. Yeah.
So he's dressed what you can only describe as a Chinaman.
Yes.
And he's going, I suppose I better sell this bric-a-brac here or something. He tries to knock on a side door and he knocks on the door and I open the door and I'm in a vest in an apron with a meat cleaver.
Naturally.
Saying, bog off, you Chinese twit. And then you hear the flutes of the... well, like in Seinfeld, there's the bass, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Dun, dun, yeah. Dun.
And then I think with Last of the Summer Wine, it was the flutes,
yes,
isn't it? And, I remember the director just kind of going, looking at me going, give him more grease. They just slapped this oil all over my vest. And I'm just going, he's got to get better than this. Actually, I've got a letter that I kept this letter and it's like, dear Benedict, I thank you for appearing in Aladdin Gets on Your Wick episode. Sadly, your character will not be reprised.
No!
Yeah, I was saddened about that.
I want a spin-off. Because
it's gone on for how many seasons?
It's still going. I think it's still going. No, it stopped. It has stopped. Yeah. It has stopped. But yeah, something like 30 years.
Yeah.
Something like that, Last of Summer Wine.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an astonishing introduction, I guess, to screen acting. Wow. So Blakey was playing a Chinese, or he was dressed up as a Chinese guy.
Yes. Well. Yeah.
Okay. And your character was Chinese man, apparently.
Yeah, Chinese man.
Chinese man, yeah.
And then I moved on to, I think, like Thug One. I think I was in an episode with,
at least that was one. At least it was Thug One. Not Thug Three, not Thug Four.
I remember it was with Brian Brown in a thing called The Wanderer. And I was on I never saw it, but I was playing some sort of kind of Thug One doorman.
Yeah. Mm.
And we don't let him in. We don't let him in. He gives us sort of, £50 and we let him in.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I'm a young actor. I thought, I'll kind of milk this scene. He gives me £50. I kind of go, no, it's not enough.
So you start ad-libbing to Brian Brown.
Don't do that. So that was my sort of very early on career. But, you know, you kind of...
Brian Brown does not react well to improvisation.
That cash thing, don't do it. Okay.
Because I read an interview with you a couple of years ago where you were talking about typecasting in your career. Is that something you've run up against time and time again? I'm guessing it is.
Yeah, it's quite a tough. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I'm here speaking to you, and everyone can obviously hear I'm from Salford. Or,
yeah.
That when you leave college with your friends, that you know you've been vying for parts against each other based on merits, and then you get out into that real world sometimes. Sadly, people are viewing you just as a race, and that's it, and not as an individual. And you kind of, it can be tough, you know. There's kind of sometimes you're playing. Yeah, in theatre, it makes it a lot easier. But you ride the rough with the smooth. But it's kind of like last year. I think I played about five or six gangsters, or kind of. But what do you do? You kind of sort of go, okay, well, I'm taking it, but I will take that role, but it's either a comedy, or it's like, say, if it's like in Kick-Ass, or Kick-Ass 2, or something like the Wrong Man's, or maybe if it's something slightly darker, like Run and Channel 4, or Top Boy. And something like this is incredible, you know. It's like maybe you've been waiting for something to play like this.
The Martian is, I guess, part four of your space. What's the word for a four-part thing?
Well, officially now it's quadrilogy,
isn't it? Quadrilogy, yeah. Right?
Which is a made-up word, but that's
my
cool for
space
it.
Quadrilogy. Yes, thanks, guys.
The Benny Wong space quadrilogy.
Yeah, we have, you know, I'm probably like 5 points in a pub quiz question, aren't I, with Sunshine and Moon.
Yeah.
And then obviously there's Prometheus, and then, The Martian, yeah. But it's kind of quite strange and eerie, and I don't kind of question what's going on with my CV. But if you look at the film, there's certain films that I've done are starting to kind of turn into a paragraph, like On a Clear Day, Grow Your Own, We Have Sunshine, Moon.
Yeah.
I don't really know what's going to happen.
Is this how you choose your roles? Basically, so your career will form a short story by the time you're finished.
Well, yeah, I try not to tell anybody that.
It's an esoteric way to do it. Yeah. I mean, it's unusual, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But more power to your elbow if that works out.
Yeah, I missed out on One Fine Day.
There'll always be a remake.
I've got to do that.
They'll reboot it, I tell you. Would you play the Clooney role or the Pfeiffer role?
Oh, I don't. Yeah, I love a challenge. You'll go for the Pfeiffer.
as well. Yeah. I just wanted to talk about very, very briefly, because we've got to let you go in a second, about about that sort of space trilogy. Well, The Martian, you know, let's say it's a separate thing for the time being. Sunshine, first of all, it must have been an incredible experience working in that film.
Do you know something? I was in my bedroom in Salford, opening up, this is a true story, a magazine, Empire magazine, mentioning that Danny Boyle was going to do Sunshine. And I went, I got to do this. Just called the agent up, get me an audition for this. It happened. And it was an incredible time. We were... We all lived together in the student digs, and kind of done it. We had lectures with the European Space Agency. We all experienced the zero gravity and 4G. We went to Heathrow Airport in a £60 million flight simulator landing planes. And it was like, it was so out there. It was amazing.
Yeah. I always wondered, who is the messiest in your dorm set up when you were living together? How was Chris Evans? Was he pretty squared away?
No, I think all I remember was we all kind of cooked. I think Hiroyuki Sanada had cooked salmon, but it stank the entire dorm. Really, I think. And then we were but we all, and he's got his guitar out. We're having a little bit of a sing-song. It's quite fun, actually. Yeah.
Amazing. Never cook salmon in a shared accommodation. Yeah, no. Don't do it. It'll lead to a sticky end. But now you're doing the Martian, your second go-round with Sir Ridley.
Hmm.
And how's that comparing so far to your Prometheus experience?
Oh, it's great. I mean, it's lovely to see him again. You know, it's quite the film. Who am I working with now? We're working with Jeff Daniels and Kristen Wiig.
Wow.
Chiwetel Ejiofor. Who else? Donald Glover, Mackenzie Davis, and Sean Bean. Yeah.
Hell of a cast.
Yeah.
And you're a boffin.
That's just in our section. Yeah.
Stay away from Sean Bean because he always cops it, doesn't he? Quite early.
Does he? Yeah. Either him or me, anyway. So
the two of you go through the script, go, oh, I've got page 74. You've got 90. Suck
right,
it in.
You did.
Yep. Sticky hand in sunshine, sticky hand in Prometheus.
Yeah.
And,
I think I'm grounded now in this sci fi film, So.
You must bring a lot of pre-knowledge to these things now. After all of your experiences on Moon and those other movies, you must be like, it's basically...
You know, you don't want to be the class SWAT, do you? You just...
Yeah, you do.
Modestly kind of... No, I don't know.
All right, well, Benny, it's been a pleasure, man. We've got to let you go.
Oh, it's great.
Do you fancy a quick Game of Street countdown?
Come on, let's go for it.
Here, let's do it.
Okay, let's go. Cheers. Where's the car park? Downstairs?
Downstairs, around the back, yeah.
Okay.
This is Empire, we don't have a car park. But you do owe us money, actually, for your Sunshine gig. If we got you that gig, that's a tenner each.
Okay,
before we let you. It's been a pleasure. Thanks,
brilliant.
Man.
Brilliant. Thanks, guys. Cheers.
What a lovely chap, Phil.
He was a lovely chap. Very and nice he's guy. Really, really good in Marco.
Yes. Polo.
Polo.
Sorry.
Guys.
I know. Let
Polo.
You down. Let you down.
Too late.
Let you down. Sorry. Okay, so time for now some movie news that hasn't, leaked from emails. Anything official and whatnot?
I've got something official, but it's not necessarily new news, but it is something I think we ought to talk about on the podcast. A little time after the last week's podcast, obviously in between that time, there's been our Review of the Year podcast, which came out on Thursday, which you should go and listen to if you haven't done so already. It's about an hour and a bit's worth of us talking quite a lot of nonsense about a lot of our favourite movies and least favourite movies. Anyway, so on Friday, last week, it emerged that Roberto Orci will not be directing Star Trek 3. It was a bit of a coup for him at the time when it was announced. I certainly was surprised myself that one of the co-writers of the new rebooted version of Star Trek, as helmed by J.J. Abrams, had got the leg up. He's been given the push up into the director's chair. And a lot of people were like, no, he's not the person we'd want to direct this one. Also, a lot of people are blaming him for the surprising nature of what happened in Into Darkness. He's now no longer part of the Star Trek 3 directing team. He will be involved. He's still there. But he's no longer directing, and of course everyone is now enjoying the idea of who might be the next one. Jonathan Frakes, who directed Insurrection, the Next Generation movie, and of course First Contact, he was Riker, the best bearded man in Star Trek universe.
What a beard.
What a beard. He also, I think, tucked his shirt down better than anybody else in that bridge.
I'm not going to stand for
that. He did a good shirt
tuck.
I'm
not going to stand for that.
Mm.
Picard, man, Picard.
Oh. Also, there's that amazing sequence where he has his beard shaved in the bath, in the bubble bath, and it's quite erotic. Anyway, so he has thrown his hat into the ring saying, wouldn't it be lovely if I directed that movie, the fabled Star Trek 3 or Star Trek 13. It is very unlikely that Frakes will be given that shot. We were talking in the office earlier that I think work after his Star Trek work, and by the way, Insurrection's pants, but Thunderbirds is not exactly high cinema, and I don't see this happening. People have also been talking about Edgar Wright, and I would view that as quite unlikely too, but again, wouldn't it be lovely?
Would it be, let me see, so Simon Pegg's in Star Trek 13 and Edgar Wright directs it. Does that make it a Cornetto film? Does that make it the fourth part of their trilogy? Who knows?
If Nick Frost is a Klingon.
True, yeah.
If he's Worf's cousin.
I like it. I just can't see him doing it, which obviously means the second this podcast gets put live, there'll be an announcement that Edgar Wright will direct Star Trek 3. I just can't see him doing it. I think he'll want to do his own thing next, surely, won't he?
I'm sure he'll be on the shortlist. Yeah. I mean, so many people are on the shortlist, but I just don't see it happening. Also, there's not much time to get this done. It needs to start shooting in 2015 for a 2016 release, so it's a pretty tight turnaround. So we'll see who they get, but frankly, I'm kind of pleased that Orci isn't doing this one, because I think it needs a more established presence to keep this franchise going.
I agree.
Yeah,
Sorry, big prank there.
I agree. It's kind of interesting how Orci, who, you know, obviously was on this podcast, the Star Trek and the Darkness spoiler special and whatnot, that's a movie that for us, I think, has diminished in the time since its release. And you could lay a lot of the blame for that at his door, you would think. But also, he, I think, of the brain trust that worked on those movies, he is seen as the biggest Trekker. So it might be a good thing that he's still involved, possibly, to be some sort of custodian of the J.J. Abrams vision for that franchise. But maybe it'd be nice to have a clean break.
It's funny because the first Star Trek film, the first of the reboot, blasted the whole thing back. It became really big and exciting again. And the second one seems to have just let all the air out of that tire.
It has a little
bit. In a way that I just... they're going to have to start the whole thing over and re-excite people, especially as it's now entering a much more crowded franchised marketplace. So good luck to them, really. Just swiftly, the Inside Out trailer broke, which is Pixar's... it feels like their most high-concept, tight-wire idea for a movie for quite some time. Probably, I don't know, Up or even Ratatouille. So it's exciting to see it. And what they've done is they've basically just showed a clip from the film. It's not done the trailer thing of skipping around the story because it's such a high concept thing. If you don't know what it is, it's basically the story's the emotions, the five emotions inside your head.
Joy and fear.
Joy, fear, anger, exactly, ambiguity, ambivalence. I may have got that wrong.
That itch in your bum when you've been sitting on the itchy bus for bum. Too long.
Itchiness isn't one of them, but it's along those lines.
Elbows.
Again, not really a common emotion.
Oh.
You're making me feel elbow is not something you hear
very
often. Anyway, but check out the trailer. It's online right now.
Does anyone remember the numbskulls?
Yes, from, of course, the Beano.
The Beano.
It's very similar where you had different people. But numbskulls was different because they had different rooms. You had the ear numbskull and you had the brains and you know whatever. Yes. Whereas this for me is odd because for Pixar... that's all about rounded characters, believable for kids or kiddie characters that are entirely rounded, believable beings, be they fish, clownfish, or be they old men with sticks and floating houses. This seems to be slicing up a child into these emotions. Mm-hmm. I feel that's not what Pixar is. Now, I am, as ever, ready to be proved horribly wrong by this, but I find the idea of divvying up different characters and defining them by an emotion, and I'm overanalyzing it.
No, I don't think you are. I think it depends upon, all Pixar films depend upon it working on that level. I think you need to,
and I don't think Pixar would consider themselves to be making kids films.
No,
not anymore. Certainly not anymore. And this is Pete Docter, the man who made their last great movie and for me their masterpiece, Up. So I'm fully on board with this.
I know what you mean. They've got a job to do a bit further down the line in really selling how it's going to work, but I think the trailer is fun and exciting and interesting and colourful and bright and got some funny bits. And I mean, it is a bit like a puppet show, isn't it? Like this girl's being manipulated by these five emotions and they're all arguing amongst themselves. Reminds me of a way that it probably shouldn't do, of everything you always wanted to know about sex but were afraid to ask. When he's inside the brain, do you remember when Woody Allen's inside the brain and launching different sort of erotic sensations around the body? It's the least appropriate parallel ever, but it is a similar idea.
I prefer Chris's numbskulls, frankly.
Second bit of Pixar news is some plot details from Dory. Turns out that Dory's child has been slaughtered by three wizened fishermen on a boat off New England, and she's looking for revenge in the Caribbean. No, sorry, that's the plot of Jaws 4. That's not what's happening. Dory is basically looking to find her family. So it's a similar sort of idea to the original, in a way, but it's now Dory's story. Ellen DeGeneres' character, who is famously forgetful, will probably have other challenges to face. But it sounds interesting. What's interesting about this one is that it was originally going to be set in a kind of SeaWorld environment, but SeaWorld is now in such bad odour after the whole blackfish thing that they've had to steer away from that. There is still a kind of a marine conservation facility on the Californian coastline where the movie will be predominantly set, and there's going to be lots of exciting new characters, including an octopus, sadly not the one from the Penguins of Madagascar, a sea lions and a beluga whale. I'm excited, and this film is out in July 2016, so not for a while yet, but they are at least telling us what to expect.
In my head, it's not like SeaWorld, it's like Marine Conservation Whale Centre in Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, where it's just lovely, lovely people having a lovely time walking around two whales who are also having a lovely time, and sometimes Leonard Nimoy is swimming with them.
Yes, because the first one was a bit Search for Spock, wasn't it? So there is a clear, sort of.
There's a terrible, terrible essay to be written about the parallels between Finding Nemo and the Search for Spock.
Star Trek. Sea Trek.
Yeah. I will write that essay.
Do it.
I will not publish it. Just like my 30 greatest movie bus moments.
Oh.
The greatest lost article in Empire Online history.
It's not lost. I mean, I know exactly where it is.
It is lost.
There's a new great bus moment that we saw in the Terminator Genisys trailer, which has a whole school bus, which is as long as a bridge, getting flipped from what looks like bumping into another car. I don't know, but that's a great bus moment.
Last week we talked very briefly about the Star Wars trailer and the Terminator Genisys trailer. We should very, very briefly mention that there was another cracker of a trailer this week. Obviously, discussing trailers in the podcast is a bit weird and redundant because it's... Anyway, Mad Max Fury Road. Last night, this trailer dropped, which is absolutely astonishing and has just visuals that will blow your mind. And I think it's got a lot of people excited about the possibility of Mad Max Fury Road. Which in a year, with cracking trailers like Avengers Age of Ultron... And by the way, anyone watch the San Andreas trailer?
I gather that The Rock punched something?
The Rock punches an earthquake, but the effect already of the Avengers Age of Ultron trailer is being felt in other trailers, because it's got an eerie song being sung in a haunting, lilting manner over images of destruction, and you're just going, oh, really? Okay, that's very Age of Ultron-y. But yeah, and obviously the Star Wars trailer as well, but this trailer, Mad Max Fury Road, wow. Go and check it out. I've got a couple of bits of news I want to talk about. One bit of news is really exciting me. Is the news that Al Pacino has had meetings with Marvel's Kevin Feige over a potential role in the MCU going forward.
You got a great big ass god!
Terrible accent, but the joke still stands.
Oh, Kevin. Oh, yeah. I love it.
Should I do Pacino doing Hans Gruber doing Eddie Vedder?
I don't know what's happening.
Helen goes for 1 week.
And suddenly we've got a great big ascot.
I'm excited about this. I think it could be cool. It may not come to anything, obviously, but Pacino, I love Pacino, and he's talking a lot more than he used to. He's doing loads of interviews everywhere for everything. So hopefully, Al, if you're listening to this, and I know you are, then do, you know, plant your ass in the pod booth when you get over to promote the humbling. But that'd be great. And people are speculating about what he could do. Would he be a bad guy in Doctor Strange, or would he be Peter Quill's dad in Guardians of the Galaxy 2? The age difference kind of works for me. That would kind of work. I think that might be all right.
I like the idea of a Doctor Strange villain.
Yeah.
Maybe Doctor Strange dad.
Ooh. Jeff Strange.
Simon Strange.
Mr. Strange. It could be quite interesting. That would be fun.
I've got a quick question. If Doctor Strange is a surgeon...
Yes.
Everyone knows that surgeons aren't actually doctors. They are very proud of the fact that they're misters. Surely it should be Mr. Strange.
Maybe that's a British thing. We need Helen for that one. Maybe surgeons are doctors in America. I'm not sure. Write in and tell us. If you're a surgeon, probably get back to work. But then write in and tell us when you finished your operation.
It might be a British thing. The Turk on Scrubs is a surgeon, and he's a doctor, isn't he?
Tell you what, you carry on, I'm going to Google it.
This is what we're reduced to in the podcast. We're discussing whether Turk from Scrubs is a doctor or a mister.
You're wondering where all these facts come from. Yeah. I mine them from my brain.
Awesome news this week. Sean Levy has left the Minecraft movie, as I suspected. And last but not least, John Lee Hancock is going to make a movie about the founder of McDonald's.
Because there's a story that will unite everyone.
It will.
Al Pacino's play Hamburglar. You want fries with that? Okay, I'll give you fries.
This meat patty is made from a great big ass. Beebly beep, beebly beep. We've come back into the Empire podcast.
We have, Ali.
We've come back a day after when we normally record it, which is Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
So today is then Friday.
Correct.
So you're getting this on Friday.
People are getting this on Friday. Phil is no longer here.
Yes.
Yesterday was his birthday. Today is his birthday plus one.
He had an accident with this massive... basically, it looks like a broadsword, but it's also a lightsaber. And he chopped most of his body off.
Indeed. It's rather unfortunate. But now he's more machine now, the man, twisted and evil. My cold is developed. Apologies for anyone who likes the WC Empire Plague cast. You can now hear it in my voice, which you couldn't yesterday. But anyway, there you go. We're back in the podcast booth because two reasons. Number one, we wanted to talk about the Golden Globes, which were announced after we recorded the podcast yesterday, which is very nice of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association to do that. But first of all, we're going to discuss last night's big news that J.J. Abrams has revealed to Entertainment Weekly and now the rest of the internet the names of the new characters we see in the Star Wars The Force Awakens trailer. So, John Boyega, the stormtrooper we see at the very, very beginning, is Finn. F-I-N-N. Daisy Ridley getting on the land speeder in what may or may not be Tatooine.
And on a giant floating magnum.
Indeed. Is Rey, R-E-Y, which indicates that J.J. Abrams is a Crowded House fan and a Lana Del Rey fan, and he's been naming these characters by looking around his record collection. Then we have Oscar Isaac, the X-Wing pilot, who is Poe Dameron.
Poe Dameron.
Good name.
Edgar Allan.
Poe Dameron, or maybe it's a Teletubbies tribute, who knows? And obviously a lot of wags the internet have been going, that sounds a bit like Cameron Poe from Con Air, which is very, very funny. And the person igniting a lightsaber, the broad saber,
is Phil DeSemelin.
It's Phil DeSemelin. He's more machine now than the man. It is Kylo Ren. Kylo Ren. K-Y-L-O-R-E-N. Two names. Very interesting thing. That's not been confirmed as Adam Driver, even though we all think it's Adam Driver. But even though he's got a red lightsaber, we're pretty sure that's a Sith apprentice. He's not called Darth. Not yet. Anyway, Kylo Ren. Very, very interesting. So this is presumably a Sith apprentice before he becomes an official Sith Lord.
Good going if you can be a Sith apprentice, i.e. a noob, a massive noob, 00B. 00B, and still have a kick-ass broadsword lightsaber.
Yeah, maybe that's how he got in.
What, he had the equipment?
Yeah.
They said, oh, well, come. Here's your audition. Come sit down. Sit down. Kylo, why do you think you're in?
Yeah.
Kylo, well done. You've made a very good point.
And BB-8.
Ah, BB-8,
let's not, forget BB-8. The little ball droid, the little gyro droid was what people were dubbing it. BB-8, BB-8 is his name, which is really cute, and you just want a BB-8 just to run around your home, in a way that you don't want an R2-D2 to run around your home.
The thing is, I like calling him Baldroid.
I do, yeah. But Baldroid does have unfortunate slash fiction connotations.
Ah, yes, the infamous Baldroid.
Yes.
Of your 17-year-old slash fiction fantasies.
Yeah. Poe Dameron unleashed his Baldroid.
So BB-8, BB-dash or BB-8.
Yes.
It's cute. I actually quite like it. I think it's all too easy to kind of cock up robot names and go letter, number, whatever. And that kind of works.
Yeah.
I have no idea as to this robot's character, but I feel like it fits it.
Rambunctious.
Cheeky.
Joyful.
Slippery.
Yes. Kickable. which is good. But the thing I like about these names, and it must have taken J.J. Abrams and Larry Kasdan
Maybe an hour.
Just looking around. I'm just looking around the office here, the pod booth. How about Mike Rofone? There's elements of that, but I really like these names. Get used to these names. You're going to be meeting a lot of babies with these names in about a year's time. What are you called? Kylo. Oh, staying away from you then, mate.
Dameron Plum.
Yeah. What's your name? BB-8 Plum. You know what I mean?
Poe Hewitt.
Poe, and that's a good name. Dameron Hewitt. Ray Hewitt. No, Ray's too. Anyway, but what I like about them is there's a combination of your typical names, which could be Earthling names. So you have Finn, you have Ray, even though it's spelled slightly differently. But you also have names that are very Star Wars. Kylo Ren, Poe Dameron. These are names that feel very Star Warsy to me. And I wonder how much of that is the influence of Larry Kasdan, who is presumably, having written The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, the man who came up with names like Bib Fortuna and Lobot. So, yeah, I think this is further proof that we're in good hands with The Force Awakens.
Still yet to find out what the character name for Mark Hamill will be. Or, of course,
Luke Starkiller.
Harrison Ford. What might he be called?
Dr. Richard Kimball.
Footy leg break.
Pointy finger man.
Grumpy voice.
When I came home, there was a man in my house.
Get off of my land spear.
There was a ball droid in my house. You find that ball droid. You find that ball droid.
Oh, I do apologise. We have the Moore story. The other Moore story we have.
The story. Yes.
The Golden Globes are here. Oh, well, not here. They're actually going to be here in early January. Yes. January the 11th, if you call that early January.
I do call it early January.
It's taking place on a Sunday. Tina Fey and Amy Poehler will be hosting again, not the rookie Gervais. And you're probably hoping that we can say Golden Globes, which is obviously nominated by and organised by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association.
The shadowy cabal of ancient film wizards.
Just a bunch of guys in cloaks with magical sticks that point at movies and make them successful. Mm. There aren't that many of them. It's not like the Oscars where it's this huge... That's even more complicated, but it's a small select group of people who should know better.
Yes. Well, the Academy numbers thousands of people.
Yeah,
not you know, not many. The Hollywood Foreign Press Association, apart from having a name that's difficult for me to say, kind of fall between the Academy, which has thousands of members, and the Sith, of which there's only two. So they're somewhere in that region. There's about 60 or 70 of them at any given time.
And they do have a reputation for picking things,
yes,
that maybe would encourage famous, pretty, well-dressed folk,
indeed,
attention-grabbing to come to their big party and have a lot of jolly fun.
They're not allowed to breed, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. There's a lot of mystery about them.
There's a handshake.
Yeah, and, a special handshake.
They have a symbol that's emblazoned on their chest and a tattoo on their forehead. Anyway, so they have in the past, for example, nominated the likes of Angelina Jolie and Johnny Depp for The Tourist, which for me was the, well, that's that then. But yes, this year, I think it's reasonably respectable. I think they've done pretty damn good. There's no leader of the pack. It's not so much a dead heat, but a decent number of nominations for the likes of, as I say, Grand Budapest Hotel, Into the Woods, which is a surprise because it's not been that well received. A lot of reviews still to come in, of course. Gone Girl and Boyhood, which has possibly done the best. Richard Linklater,
yes.
Patricia Arquette, Ethan Hawke, Richard Linklater again, screenplay. All pretty good. I mean, I'm quite pleased with this list.
It's okay. And what they do, the Golden Globes, they split into two categories. They have a drama category, then a musical or comedy category. Then, weirdly, for Best Supporting Actor and Actress, they just have one single category, which just seems weird to me. But there's some interesting ones in there. Really happy to see Pride nominated for Best Motion Picture in the musical or comedy category. That's very good. Well done, Pride. Drama, Boyhood, Foxcatcher, The Imitation Game, Selma, The Theory of Everything. So some interesting shutouts, if you will, the likes of Angelina Jolie's Unbroken, Brad Pitt and David Ayer's Fury, which maybe had been linked with being big old Oscar movies. Clint Eastwood's American Sniper, not in there. David Oyelowo gets nominated for Selma. Christoph Waltz gets his annual nomination for Big Eyes, which apparently is a comedy, according to the Golden Globes. Really interestingly, in the drama category, Jennifer Aniston for a film called Cake.
Yeah, I saw a clip of her from this film, and she looks quite distressed.
Yes.
And sad and angry.
Apparently she's very, very good in this film.
Do you know any more about Cake?
Yeah, Cake's interesting. We haven't seen it yet. It hasn't started screening in this country yet, but from what I understand, it stars Jennifer Aniston, obviously, and this is her big shot, her big look at me, I'm a respectable actress. And she's a woman who joins a support group. She's for clinically depressed, and she meets this man whose wife committed suicide, and she becomes fascinated with that and starts a relationship with the guy while digging into the circumstances behind the wife's suicide. So apparently people have been praising the performance, so I don't think she's going to win, but it's fascinating to me to see Jennifer Aniston on that list, and people are actually now beginning to talk about her seriously as a potential Oscar nominee, which is very interesting. I wouldn't have said that last year.
You wouldn't have said that after watching Horrible Bosses 2.
Well, honestly, I'm surprised she wasn't nominated for Horrible Bosses 2. In fact, I'm surprised Horrible Bosses 2 was overlooked in all other categories, to be quite frank with you.
Is there a Best Allusion to Defecation on the Chest award?
There should be.
Next year.
There bloody well should be.
It's not just movies, obviously, the Golden Globes, it's also TV. Not much love for Game of Thrones. In particular, people have been rallying for Peter Dinklage, who didn't get a nod, Sons of Anarchy, in its final season now. No nod there. It's more of your usual suspects there, really, aside from Fargo, which is good to see in the mini-series category. But you've got, in TV drama, James Spader, The Blacklist, Kevin Spacey, House of Cards, Liev Schreiber, Ray Donovan. Pleasingly... True Detective doing pretty well, and in there you've got both McConaughey and Harrelson for Best Actor in a miniseries.
Yeah, it's a good lineup. And I say it's a good lineup, and then I saw Best Original Song.
Go on.
And suddenly the Golden Globes credibility was just blown out of the water.
Go on.
Where is Everything Is Awesome? Where is it? It's not there. It's not bloody there, that's what I'll tell you.
Where
the five
it?
Songs I've nominated: Big Eyes by Lana Del Rey of Star Wars fame, from Big Eyes. Glory by John Legend and Common. That's an interesting pairing. Wow, cool. Want to hear that? From Selma. Mercy Is by Patti Smith and Lenny Kaye from Noah. Opportunity from Annie, which is an original song. Interesting. And then Lorde's Yellow Flicker Beat from The Hunger Games, Mockingjay Part 1.
I really like that song.
Good song.
Good song.
Fine song. It's okay. Where the hell is Everything Is Awesome? Where is Untitled Self-Portrait from the Lego Movie? How are these songs not, are they not eligible? I'm intrigued. I'm genuinely intrigued.
Are they too good?
They must be too good.
They must be too good.
It must be too good. Hans Zimmer was also nominated for Hammer Noetta's Organ for Interstellar, so it's good to see something came of that. Everyone said he'd go blind, but no, he's got a nomination for it, so that's good.
But notably, Interstellar really not anywhere else on the list anywhere at all.
Indeed, indeed. I still have a sneaking suspicion that Interstellar might sneak a Best Picture nomination, because the way Oscars. The Oscars work, they have 9 or 10 slots, depending on how they feel and on the morning they wake up. So it might sneak a nomination, a kind of we recognise your achievement kind of nomination. But it's not a serious contender, I would argue.
I think that is pretty much the end of our more news.
Yes. Shall we go and get rid of these cults?
What, by chopping our heads off with a broken lightsaber?
Yes, that's what the man of Buddha told me to do.
Good. Beebly beep, beebly beep.
Our second guest is an actress who stars as Tariel, in this week's The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, and who will be seen in next year's Ant-Man, possibly starring Al Pacino as Hans Gruber. But Evangeline Lilly is also now a children's author with her first book, The Squicker Wonkers, prompting people to go into a store and ask, can they get their hands on Evangeline Lilly's Squicker Wonkers with a straight face? She came into the office resplendent in a bright red top hat to talk to James Dyer and myself about the book, about hobbits, and about wasps. Enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by Evangeline Lilly. How are you?
I'm fantastic.
Excellent. You're not jet-lagged at all?
I am so jet-lagged. I am so tired. That doesn't mean I'm not fantastic. Okay. Tired and fantastic can go hand in hand.
Okay, yeah.
I'm heading to my first ever English book signing tonight, uh-huh. Which puts me in a pretty good mood. I'm also wearing a fantastic red top hat, which always puts you in a good mood.
It's a bit hard to mention the top hat, given this a podcast, but I'm fascinated by your hat.
Thank
it
you.
Is a red top hat.
It's not just a top hat. It's like it's three stories high, my top hat. I'm headed to a signing, and I have started a tradition when I go to Squicker Wonker book signings of wearing Squicker Wonker outfits.
Yes.
And so tonight I'm wearing one of my many Squicker Wonker outfits. I found this hat today. I found it in Camden Market.
That's a pretty good place to find a top hat.
It does sound good. It sounds, if you want to find a top hat in London, go to Camden Market. That seems like the best place to me. It's phenomenal. I mean, I don't think enough people wear hats these days, honestly.
Hats are they're sort of a foregone tradition, aren't they? But they're so attractive. I was saying when I was buying my hats today at the Camden Market, why don't we wear more hats in photo shoots? And of course, my very bright partner said to me, well, because they want to see your face and your hair. But I don't care about my face and my hair. I like fashion. I like style.
Yeah, but you've written a book. I mean, you're about to go to Forbidden Planet, which is next door to us, to sign copies of the Squicker Wonkers, which is the greatest name.
Thank you.
What
a name. And it sounds particularly good with any version of a British accent. It does, especially Scottish. I'm a really big fan of the Squicker Wonkers.
The Squicker Wonkers.
That's right. Yeah,
so Billy Connolly to say it.
I actually had Sylvester McCoy voice the audiobook because I wanted to hear the whole book in a Scottish accent.
Very good.
Available on audible.com. Little plug there.
I have a question for you. So, the beginning of the book, you dedicate it to your mother and you say that she believed in this when she first read it 20 years ago.
That's right.
Does that mean you wrote it 20 years ago?
Well, now I wrote it 21 years ago.
Okay, no, fair.
I was 14 when I first wrote The Squicker Wonkers. I was obsessed with Dr. Seuss. I thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And I thought if he could have this sort of irreverent use of language and he could make up words when he wanted to make a rhyme, I could make up words when I wanted to have a bit of a laugh. And so I just sat in my room because I was a very cool 14-year-old with a very active social life and sat down down and wrote strange words that I thought sounded neat. And the one that stuck, the one that I liked the most, was the word squickerwonker. And so I wrote a poem to go along with it. And that poem is going to be released in the limited edition Squickerwonker book coming out in December. So you can read the original poem I wrote when I was 14, which is different from the poem that you see in the book today. But the plot hasn't changed.
It will be good to see it in your original 14-year-old handwriting.
You know what? The truth of that is that my original 14-year-old handwritten poem burned in my house fire in 2005.
No!
Yeah, there's a little drama for you. Oh, no. Spice up the interview.
So you've been sitting on these squickery words for almost 20 years before you started writing it again. What brought out the squicker inside you, so to speak?
I was working on The Hobbit with Peter Jackson, and I would go into this amazing workshop he has called Weta Workshop in New Zealand, where untold amounts of creativity just ooze out of the pores of everybody that walks the halls in that workshop. And the workshop's amazing at fostering their artists to not only do incredible work for the workshop, but to also pursue their own passions and their own projects. So along with the task at hand, there's always, you know, personal passion projects sort of hanging from walls on cubicles, and everyone's got their little thing they're working on that they want to show you. And I thought, man, I've wanted to be a writer for about 5 years, and if this isn't my opportunity, if this isn't the moment that I should do it, I don't know what is. With all of these resources and all of this creativity at my disposal, I have to take advantage of it. And so my illustrator was an artist at the Weta Workshop, and he loved the Squickerwonker poem, and he's actually the one that suggested that the Squickerwonkers be marionette puppets in a traveling wagon. Oh, yeah, the original poem, they were not.
Okay, so it's a true collaboration.
I rewrote the poem probably 35 times throughout the illustrative process because I loved his illustrations so much and I was so inspired by them. I kept thinking, well, it doesn't really work with the poem, but screw it, I'll just change the poem.
As we can attest, writers, of course, don't make a particularly good living, so it's good that you have something that can enable you to continue writing.
Exactly, exactly.
And this is, I mean, when you look at the story, it's an origin story. It's how she becomes a Squickerwonker. So presumably you're opening the gates to many more adventures.
Only 18.
Oh, good.
Only 18. Not too many. Two series. The first series, The Demise of the Squickerwonkers, will be 9 books. And the second series, The Origins of the Squickerwonkers, will be 9 books.
You've been working with Peter Jackson too long.
I've heard people say, you know how there are people out there who have commitment issues? They don't really like to commit to things. You might have an over-commitment issue. Everything you do runs on and on and on and on. First there was Lost that went on for 6 years. Then there was The Hobbit that was three-hour films out of one tiny children's book. Uh-huh. Now you've signed up for Marvel and you're only doing 18 Squickerwonker books. It's only big things in my life.
I presume you signed up for, what, 35 Marvel films?
Of course, who hasn't?
Well, you've signed up for 25.
Yeah. Really?
We're just in the background. You've just finished filming that, man, haven't you?
I did. And I had a great time.
Yeah. I mean, was that a strange experience for you, given everything that happened so publicly with Edgar leaving the production so late in the day?
You know, I think that for me, I actually hadn't signed my contract when the split happened, where Edgar and Marvel decided to go separate ways. And so I was in the advantageous position of being able to decide whether or not I would walk with him. Because all of us actors signed on under the guise that Edgar would be the director, and we were all very excited about that idea, as was Marvel, very excited about the idea. We're all big fans of Edgar. And, you know, one of the things I was able to do was sort of just ride the process and see what the end result would be. Would it be that this film was going to take a turn for the worse because of these decisions that were being made? Mm. Or did it make sense? Was it just a creative difference and that it wasn't, one wasn't better than the other? And ultimately, that's what I concluded, was that Edgar was making a film that I would really like to see. And I would have really liked to be a part of. And, you know, I kind of wish we could do both versions, because the version we made is a version that very much fits within the world that Marvel has already created. And their universe is so, you know, it's so insular. It's been created so that it's all-encompassing and everything works together. And you can take any Marvel film and watch them back-to-back and it's the same world. So that's what we created. Edgar's, I think, was in Edgarland. You know, it was a different film. But, like, who doesn't want to be in Edgarland? So I kind of wish we could make both movies.
And you play Hope Van Dyne, who's Michael Douglas's Hank Pym's daughter. What was that experience like, being playing Michael Douglas's daughter?
When I first signed on, it didn't really occur to me kind of how momentous that was, what a big deal that was. Mm. I just, oh, great, Michael. Oh, yeah, Paul, okay, wonderful, great cast. I'm very clinical about deciding what roles I'll take. And so I sort of am checking boxes. And Michael became a box I checked. Okay, great, they've cast that one. Well, moving on, and sort of carried on with my process of checks and balances. And then I got to work and started working with him. And then about halfway through my shooting, I had to do this very intense emotional scene with Michael Douglas. Mm. And it wasn't until midway through shooting this scene with him that suddenly the penny dropped and it occurred to me, oh my God, I'm acting opposite Michael Douglas. This is a legendary star. And not, you know, he's a consummate actor, and it hit me. And the reason it hit me was because I had been working with him for long enough to have suddenly kind of realized, oh my God, he's such a force. You know, every time he shows up on set, every time they call action, what he brings into the room, it makes the room electric. It sort of brings everything to life. And I realized I was standing before and had the fortunate privilege of working with a living legend.
I imagine as part of the relationship establisher in the film, they might use pictures of Hank and Hope as, you know, in earlier times. Do you have to supply your own pictures, your own childhood pictures? I'm always interested in this. Do you have to supply your own? Do you have to go back and root through your stuff? And
we
then
we actually didn't do that.
Really?
We didn't. And I don't think you'll see that picture.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Believe it or not. I've had to do that before. I had to do that on Lost once. That was very humiliating. I was a very bad-looking little girl. I had buck teeth, freckles, no figure, no. I mean, I looked like Laura Ingalls. Do you remember? Do you guys have Little House on the Prairie over here?
Yes.
Yes.
I looked exactly like Laura Ingalls. The two braids and everything.
Wow. That's
amazing.
Was that something you aspired to? Or was that something did your parents just style you in that way?
It just happened to be that every single member of my family looked like the Ingalls. We were the Ingalls doppelgangers. That's what we were.
And for everyone listening, which episode was that exactly so we can go and find it?
Everyone for the first, I would say, 3 or 4 years. Once she got older, I don't know if we still, I mean, she probably got beautiful. But when she was young and awkward, very, very similar.
So we should look for pictures of her wearing a top hat and see, and make a big, the comparison.
A big, tall, red top hat.
A big red top hat. And the last thing I'll ask about Ant-Man is the Fandine name is generally associated with wasp-like creatures or wasp-like
that
abilities.
That is correct.
Can you give any indication where that might go?
I can actually. I don't even have to hide. My parents were Hank Pym and Janet Van Dyne. So my parents were Ant-Man and Wasp. Mm-hmm. I was raised by two superheroes. So I'm a pretty screwed up human being in this movie. I am also fairly capable, strong, and kick-ass, which is wonderful to play. But the most fun to play was just how messed up she was from being raised by two superheroes. And the clear message sent by my name is that I'm not a big fan of my father.
Okay.
And so I took my mother's name.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And of course, you've just reached the end of your unexpected journey with The Hobbit. How does it feel now? I mean, do you have a sense now you're out of it? I know you finished filming over a year ago, but do you feel now that it's finally over, I can put that in a box and that's done as part of my history?
You know, it went in a box when I finished filming.
Really?
And it always does, because otherwise you're just dying to see it. You kind of have to put it aside and forget about it because you work so hard on a project. And then as, you know, film actors, you have to wait a very long time before you get to see the final result and find out if people even like it. Mm. So usually, you know, psychologically, the best route to take is just to, for me anyways, to put it aside, put it out of your mind. And then when you get to the premiere, it's this grand surprise and it's this great celebration and you have a great time saying, yay, look what we did and everyone loves it. Isn't that great? But you emotionally, I'm not attached the way I was when I was filming.
And I just want to ask one last thing about Lord of the Rings and, The Hobbit rather, and Tauriel. Hell of an accent.
Oh, well, thank you.
Oh, well, you know, but where did it come from? Did you study or did you have anyone you were using as inspiration?
I'm just going to just sit here for a minute and just accept and absorb that for a minute. I am such a perfectionist and I was so, so scared to tackle an English accent because I know from personal experience just how critical English people are of Americans trying to do an English accent. And So I was terrified. And of course, because it's Middle Earth, we had to do a an RP accent, basically non-regional, nondescript. And sometimes what happens with that is people will accuse you of not doing an authentic English accent because they say, but that doesn't sound like anyone living in England right now. Phew, thank you. And I give all the credit to the absolutely incredible dialect coach who worked with us, Leith McPherson, on mm-hmm. The Hobbit. Mm-hmm. She and I would get in a room together and just geek out. She's nerds out. She loves language. We both love and obsess over language and accent and especially Elvish. Mm-hmm. We really, really like Elvish. And I had a lot of fun doing the Elvish, but I was so nervous and so paranoid doing an English accent because I just thought I'd get lambasted. So thank you.
So first day on set, really nervous. I'm like,
really. I mean, the amount of weight on my shoulder. I was doing actually my first day on set, I got given the scene the night before we shot.
Yeah.
I was leading, like commanding a group of six other actors who had been working together for a year. I was speaking Elvish. Mm-hmm. I was speaking in an English accent. I was pretending to be an elf, which I'd never tried to do before, let alone on camera. And I was healing an orc wound. So I was very nervous.
See, around here, that's just a Tuesday for us.
Yeah. Did the victim pull through?
He did.
Good.
I succeeded.
Well, there you go. You worked on all levels.
Just another day in the office.
Were you at all jealous then of the likes of Richard Armitage and Luke Evans, who got to... You know, they didn't get to speak in RP. Luke rolls out his Welsh accent.
Very good, it's bad,
oh yes, mm-hmm. and Richard Armitage has got a bit of Yorkshire in there. So, were you jealous of those guys?
I was jealous, but I wouldn't have traded places for the world because I liked the challenge. Okay. I love doing Tauriel. I love playing that part because I'd never been so intellectually challenged by a role. Yeah. Usually, I mean, the role that I was most known for, playing Kate on Lost, was not so intellectually challenging. You might be able to tell from the character. It was very emotionally challenging, but not so intellectually challenging. And I am, I have kind of reams of intellectual energy that needs to be spent or I can't sleep at night.
Okay.
But emotional energy, I might be the laziest woman in the world.
That's genius.
Phenomenal. And I think on that bombshell... It's time to say farewell. Evangeline Lilly, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. You. Thanks, guys. Thank you.
I got an interesting fact.
Okay. Okay.
Surgeons are no longer called Mister in this country either. And I think it's only a British thing. I think in America they're called doctors.
Holy cow.
But they want to be called doctors, apparently.
We've blown this thing wide open.
They're ending the tradition.
How strange.
Good tie-in.
There is a character in the Marvel Universe called the Owl. So that could work nicely for Pacino. He could be going, oh, what are you, the fucking the Owl? Just an idea. Right, let's kick off the review section with, basically, there's only one major film out this week and a lot of movies running away from it. It's The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, directed, of course, by Peter Jackson. Our resplendent guest-edited edition is still on sale. Go and pick it up. If you're a fan of The Hobbit, if you're a fan of The Lord of the Rings, if you're a fan of Peter Jackson, if you're a fan of Michael J. Fox, if you're a fan of magazines, and if you're a fan of reading, and if you're a fan of paying £3.99 for amazing magazines, go and pick it up from all good and evil newsagents right now. Right, that's a shameless plug over. Cupid Fury is also out on DVD and Blu-ray. Let's talk about The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies. This is the conclusion of The Hobbit saga. A saga that didn't start as a saga but then turned into a saga.
I can give you a brief setup as to what we're talking about here.
Okay, let me do a quick intro. So, Ali.
Well, we're all going to talk about this one because it is the big movie, certainly of this month, I'd say. But at the end of The Desolation of Smaug, Smaug has been... You know who'd have made... Sorry, Benedict. Who'd have made a great Smaug? Al Pacino. He really would have made a great...
So many dwarfs!
Sorry, what?
Out of his lair. And he is about to set up on Lake Town. You've seen the great posters. You've seen our front covers. He's about to roast it up a notch. He's going to take the oven setting way up to 11. And it's Balder Bowman, as played by Luke Reddy Bloody Evans, who is the only man with the bow to take him on.
The Black Arrow.
He's right there, right at the beginning. That's the very first set piece of this film, is the dragon happening. Mm-hmm. So I don't reveal too much because, believe it or not, some people haven't read the book and they may not know what's about to happen. But that is the first set piece. But then, of course, you have the big battle between the elves, mm-hmm. the humans of Lectown, the eagles, the orcs, and the dwarves. Mm-hmm. And this all happens in and around Dale and the mountain and that whole area. Now, you were probably looking forward to this big, massive set piece, and I think it's fair to say that Peter Jackson was too. This is definitely, I think, one of those, well, now I'm on. I'm really making this movie now when the battle actually happens. But again, for being a kid's book, a lot of different things happen that we can't talk about here. There are some sad moments, characters leave us, all that sort of thing.
There's a body count. Yep.
There is a body count, there's no doubt about it. And you do get plenty of action, but unfortunately you do get plenty of waffling about and a little bit of going here, then going there, then picking this up and then incidental characters. But yes, this is basically a massive big battle with a little bit of preamble beforehand. It is a fitting conclusion to this trilogy, as you say, and the unexpected trilogy. It's still got similar problems to the previous two films. It's not up there with Smaug, which I certainly think is the best of the three. And yeah, I think it's probably on a par with Unexpected Journey. I personally loved it when it got going. When the battle actually got started, I was really into it and I really felt for it. There's some really lovely Jackson-like beats. There's a moment where characters leap over each other. Orlando Bloom's Legolas gets a lot to do mm-hmm. and looks damn good doing it. But I wonder whether, with there being so many dwarves and so many characters, and the way that this story is actually put together, this isn't necessarily Jackson's fault, it was difficult to really truly emotionally connect with a lot of these characters so that when things do happen to them, you don't necessarily feel for them. That said, it did get me a few times, especially with some of the bigger characters. It's a good film, and it's well worth seeing on the big screen, but it's a difficult one to review.
It is a tricky one to review, just in terms of giving away plot spoilers. Hey, lo and behold, we're going to have two spoiler specials for this movie coming up very, very soon. First one is going to be with Philippa Boyens, the co-writer of all of the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit movies, and she's talking to Ian Nathan and Helen O'Hara. That one, she's talking a great deal about all the third act stuff, which is really fascinating because there's a lot of changes from the book, a lot of interesting things, a lot of little interesting tweaks as well, because the battle essentially is taken care of after the fact in the book, and so there's a lot of room for Peter Jackson and co to crowbar their imagination into. Listen out for that one. A couple of days after that drops will be the traditional spoiler special where we talk about, it's the Team Empire talking about it and nattering about it in great spoilerific detail, and that will also include an interview with Richard Armitage. So do check those out where we can talk about the stuff we can't talk about right now. Having said that, there's a rush to kind of diss the Hobbit trilogy, and you can see that it's not as good, artistically speaking, as the Lord of the Rings trilogy. That's absolutely fine. But for me, this trilogy has delivered on a lot of levels, and this film delivers for me on a lot of levels. The spectacle, you cannot argue with the spectacle. The battle itself is fantastic. The desolation of Lake Town, if that's what we want to call it, is great. There's a lovely moment between Bard and Smaug himself, which I think people will get a real kick out of. And there's a lot of good performances, most notably Martin Freeman, who I still continue to think delivers possibly the best performance in all six films as Bilbo. And Richard Armitage really comes into his own here as Thorin Oakenshield, who succumbs, he becomes a king under the mountain, and he succumbs to a dragon sickness, if you will, which is left behind by Smaug and all this contaminated gold, which gets into Thorin's consciousness. He retreats from the dwarves, becomes much more paranoid. He becomes almost a villain in many ways in this movie. And I think this is the movie that Armitage is really looking forward to. This is the arc that he was really looking forward to getting his teeth into. He gets an awful lot of stuff to do in this movie, and he does it very, very well indeed. Great fight sequences. It got me a couple of times, which is interesting because I haven't really... I'm a big fan of the book and the Lord of the Rings book, but honestly, and I've said this before in the podcast, I haven't really engaged that much emotionally with the films. They kind of just passed me by a little bit. But yeah, I really enjoyed this. And there's some just lovely little moments of visual invention and lovely little moments that happen in the battle, that, which goes on for a long time, that I think people will get a kick out of.
Dwarves look amazing in their big old school dwarven battle armour.
Yep.
And it is one of those movies that if you really buy into this world, you will feel heartsick that it doesn't exist. Why is there not this massive mountain? Why aren't these ginormous stone dwarf statues just actually there? Why can't I go visit them, please? Why, when I go to New Zealand, if I ever go, will it not really be Hobbiton? But it is not a perfect film by any means, but it delivers,
yeah,
certainly. And I also felt watching it that it's yet another, well, I can't wait for the extended edition, because then I'll find out this, I'll find out that, and there'll be more colour to this, that and the other, because there's just so much going on when you actually get down to it. And he's been good on delivering the bigger, better extended editions.
Yeah, weirdly enough, this is the shortest of the Hobbit trilogy. This is 2 hours and 20 minutes, a brisk 2 hours and 20 minutes. And yes, at the end of it, I kind of felt myself going, this could actually do with an extra 20. Because there are so many subplots that aren't really tied up in a neat little bow, and so many characters who aren't given the big send-off. I'm not asking for a Return of the King-style 14 endings. I'm just asking for some characters to be given their due. And from conversations we've had with Philippa Boyens and Richard Armitage, there's a fair amount of footage, I think, that will be added to the movie in due course.
To be clear, on Monday is when you're going to get the Philippa Boyens, this coming Monday, which is, let me work this out, 12:30. The 15th, December the 15th, that's going to be like a half an hour, like kind of mini episode. And then it's on Wednesday, you're going to get the full analysis plus Thorin Oakenshield himself coming in to talk about it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're covering this film. And as we mentioned, there is a magazine of some sort, which is in part dedicated to Peter Jackson and these movies.
Indeed. 4 stars then for The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies. A fitting conclusion, I think, to all 6 movies. Unless, of course, Peter Jackson decides to actually make Silmarillion, in which case we'll be here in another couple of years just doing it all over again.
The last one was okay. The one before it I thought was really bad. But I just done my dash with it.
So you're one of the people I was talking about earlier on.
Look, we sat in this podcast and we talked about this whole thing, you know, back before when Guillermo del Toro was attached, and it sounded like really interesting. One Guillermo del Toro Hobbit movie, you know, I'd be first in the queue. Then it was going to be Peter Jackson, and then it was 2 movies, and they were like, okay, that could work, you know, Peter Jackson revisiting his old ground, that could be great, and The Hobbit I grew up with. Then it was 3 movies, and the first one was just long, and I don't know, somewhere along the line I've just sort of reached a point where I've had enough of The Hobbit, frankly.
It's very interesting. Not a lot of films. A lot of films are out this week, but not a lot of films that are really going head to head with The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies. Lots of studios giving it a wide berth, which is kind of interesting. There's a bit of a logjam over the next couple of weeks. We've got Dumb and Dumber 2, we've got Night at the Museum, Secret of the Tomb, we have Annie, Big Eyes, Exodus, Gods and Kings, Unbroken. All 4 of those movies open on the same day, Boxing Day. But everyone's avoiding The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies. Presumably, I guess, because they expect people will just turn out in droves to see how the whole thing ends. That's my guess. But very, very briefly, is a British indie called Electricity, which stars Agnes Dean. It's out in key cities this week, and Phil Catt's going to talk about it.
I think this is the film that everyone's running scared of this week. Electricity, it's a low-budget British film, and it is a story about a girl who comes into a bit of money, a windfall, when her mother dies, and goes out and with her brother to find another brother of theirs who's gone missing, who they thought was dead but isn't. And basically it's her journey, and it's complicated by her epilepsy, which is captured cinematically in this movie, which, look, it's not fantastic by any means. We've given it 2 stars, but I would say that Agnes Dean shows a lot in this movie. We saw her in Pusher, the remake of the Nicholas Winding Refn thriller in the UK a couple of years ago, and she was pretty good in that, and she's really good in this as well. And you know, fair play to her for really, what's the Zoolander thing about the actor slash model slash actress and the slashies? She's so sort of past that. I think her and Cara Delevingne as well is getting some good roles, showing that, you know, models make good actresses too. So good work her, and I wouldn't say it was a hearty recommendation, but certainly something to take from the film.
2 stars then for Electricity. And really, the only show in town this week is The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies. There's a lot of interesting stuff out next week. Like I said, Contiki's out as well next week, and that's
real good. Yeah,
real
go see
good.
That.
It's Phil's favourite Thor film. So I don't know. I wanted to say it on your birthday. Just wanted to, happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
That was next week's intro Chris has given me for my birthday.
I know. I've blown my material now. That's it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film related fun and the last podcast proper of the year. The Review of the Year podcast, as Ali has said, is out now for you to listen to. Get your ears around that, and there's two Hobbit spoiler specials coming up as well if you're interested in that kind of thing. But the one next week is our last one until January 9th. Is that right?
That's right.
That's right.
This also means that there have been over 8 days, 5 podcasts. So we are giving you value for money, and considering you don't pay a damn thing. So honestly, yes, I know there's a lot in your inbox right now, but you'll have loads of time over the Christmas period.
Yeah, we're taking a 3-week break, so you can listen to
You
can listen to 5 podcasts.
Fill both of your ears up.
The Battle of the 5 podcasts. Right. Okay. Next week we'll be joined by Tim Burton, who's going to talk about Big Eyes, and the Dumb and Dumber duo of Jim Carrey, Jeff Daniels, and Peter Farrelly will be in as well.
Great maths.
I know. Dumb and Dumber maths right there. That's kind of, I was wondering if people might point that out, but
yeah, I was worried. Yeah.
Oh well. Until then, it is goodbye from Phil. Happy birthday, man.
Thanks.
It's goodbye from Ali.
It's goodbye from me. I just want to make a joke which was actually made on, I'm sorry, I haven't a clue, but it was, there are 11 types of people. Those who understand Roman numerals and those who don't.
That's good. I think that's good.
That's pretty good.
Look like we understand a joke, Chris.
Yeah, just laugh and nod. Okay, and it's goodbye from me. I'm off to listen to my pristine copy of Hans Gruber Sings the Songs of Pearl Jam. See you next week, guys. Bye.